the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for December the 30th, 2018, the last Sunday of the year, the New Year's Eve edition of the Sunday Spin. We take a look ahead to the year in the world of politics and policy, going from City Hall to the State House all the way to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of holiday coffee, and we'll do our best to get your weekend 2019 off to a great start. Well, I hope everybody had a great Christmas. I had the chance to go down to Baton Rouge for the week.
Welcome back.
Yeah, and you brought the snow, right?
That was a bit of a surprise to me when I got up yesterday morning.
Yeah, I did not recall a sticking snow as part of the forecast, but quite a time down there in the bayou. Temperature is about 60 to 70 degrees. So I hung out outside most of the time. I mean, it was, we're not going to see that for what?
You said 60 to 70?
Yeah, for 5 months.
It's going to be a long time.
But yeah, it was gorgeous. I may have to lay off seafood for a little while.
Why?
At least 48 hours.
You had your fill?
Oh, I'll tell you. Oysters, fresh oysters.
Yeah.
I don't want to tell you how many dozens of
any crawfish étouffée.
I had crawdaddies about six different ways. I mean, crawdaddy po' boy.
Oh, that would be good.
Good stuff. Some gator.
You had gator?
I had gator. Yeah. Little gator bites. Tastes like chicken.
I've never
had gator.
Yeah. No.
I've never had it.
It has the same kind of texture as chicken, really.
Does it really?
Yeah.
Yeah?
It's got some spice to it, though, doesn't it?
Well, you spice it up.
Yeah. Spice it up.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, let's see, frog legs, shrimp. You know, there's something about going to the grocery stores down there, and you go to the seafood counter, and the one store, Rouse's, had fresh shrimp. They're whole shrimp, too, which, of course, you never see that up here. But whole shrimp was like, I don't know, 12 to 15 per pound, $4.99 a pound.
Oh!
And even after you take the heads off, I mean, that's big shrimp, you
yeah,
know?
Yeah,
So I brought back 4 pounds of frozen crawdaddy tails, and I had stopped at the store and picked up some. There's a brand of red beans to make red beans and rice. That's everybody, you know, if you're going to make red beans and rice New Orleans style, you have to get these brand of red beans. And so I picked up 4 pounds. Then I was gifted another 8 pounds. So yeah, so there'll be a lot of
red beans.
Yeah,
I
think I know what
in the Pearson household.
Yeah, I think I know how the Super Bowl party is going to be.
Red beans and rice, everybody.
Indeed,
come and get it.
You bet. And then, you know, picked up some spices. They have a really cute little spice shop in Baton Rouge, and I picked up Cajun cowboy seasoning, which I guess it's like for beef and stuff like that.
How different is this from the Paul Prudhomme stuff that you can get?
Well, I think I like the Prudhomme stuff. I mean, normally, like when I cook Prudhomme, I don't buy like a mix. You know, it's do it yourself.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's, you know, red, white, and black pepper.
Yeah,
you start with that, and then you put in individual spices. So I've never been a big fan of mixes before, but this seemed like these are like grilling spices, Cajun grilling spices.
Oh, right, yeah, yeah. Paul Prudhomme's magic seasonings for his steak is amazing.
Yeah,
you do it on the grill. You can broil it.
Yeah, no, it's so. I love it down there, and it was kind of tough coming home, but I was knowing that the weather was going to be about 40 degrees different when coming in Friday night, so I wore some Blackhawks gear.
Good work.
Including my great Winter Classic sweater that Bob got me. And a woman saw me coming in and she said, "Go Blackhawks." So I figure that's G-E-A-U-X Blackhawks, because that's how they celebrate LSU down there, is within the French. And then as I was walking to get into the TSA line, one of the airline guys looked at me, and I was wearing my Blackhawks cap with the C with the tomahawks, and he goes, what sports team is that?
Oh, man.
And I said, "It's the Chicago Blackhawks." "What do they play?"
He didn't know.
No. And then, but then I he goes, "Well, I'm surprised you're not wearing Bears gear." And I said, "I really didn't want to offend down with the Saints.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly.
The number one seed."
Yeah, he says, "Oh, we're not that bad." But you know, Andy, that's the thing I wanted to tell you is, so at the airport in New Orleans, there was at least five times more LSU stuff than there was Saints stuff. And I know LSU, I think, is playing on Tuesday.
Yeah.
In their bowl game. But I was still just, I couldn't believe it with the year that the Saints are having, that it's still LSU.
College towns are college towns. And they
well, I can understand that,
you know?
But that was in New Orleans.
Oh, at New Orleans at the airport. Okay, I got you.
Yeah, this wasn't in Baton Rouge.
Okay, I thought it was in Baton Rouge.
Yeah, no, this was at the New Orleans airport.
Yeah, then that is a bit of a head-scratcher.
I mean, I was kind of confounded by that. I mean, sure, Baton Rouge, I totally understand that. I mean, everything is purple and gold in Baton Rouge. But I just, it's like, it's the Saints, man. You know, they're, and of course, they, the one thing I did notice was they had women's number nine Saints jerseys.
Mm-hmm. The Drew Brees jerseys?
With the colors.
All the glitter, yeah.
All the glitter on it. And, of course, the name on the back is Cool Breeze.
Cool Breeze.
Yeah. So, who knows? Maybe we'll get to see the Saints.
That's true.
Wouldn't that be nice?
And, you know, the thing about traveling outside of Chicago, especially during playoffs and your team is doing all right, it just makes you appreciate being here so much more.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because everybody's got a finger on the pulse. Even if you're not a sports fan, you kind of understand what's going on, and you kind of understand that the Bears are a big deal in the city, and, you know, what the Blackhawks are doing on Tuesday, playing outdoors. I mean, these are big deals.
Yeah. I mean, not that it's, you know, small city or anything like that. I mean, even Baton Rouge, the metro area for Baton Rouge is 800,000 people. I mean, that's big. But, you know, New Orleans is a good-sized place, too.
Yeah. It's all about passion, though.
Yeah. Well, and I always like to watch, like, the local newscasts, too, you know, and see kind of what's going on. And I have to tell you, if you think you see a lot of ads here in Chicago for personal injury attorneys, it's nothing compared to what you see down on Baton Rouge television. And this was a new one for me. The one I like best, it featured two attorneys with the mascot of the Saints, kind of a dog called Gumbo. The attorneys were the official personal injury law firm of the New Orleans Saints.
Oh.
I had no idea the marketing was going on.
How does one become the official?
I don't know, but I guess that means you can't rep any of the players in any case, you know, against the team.
That's true.
It might be an indemnity thing, you know. But I did see NFL Power Rankings had the Bears ranked second to the Saints.
Yeah, last week I saw the Bears anywhere between number two and number four, which is great. I mean, considering that I thought maybe number four would be the amount of wins they'd have this year before they got Khalil Mack.
Right.
Looking for number 12 today. So, yeah, definitely they're up there. And I don't really necessarily think that they're a team anybody really wants to play in the playoffs.
Well, and this is a big game today. I mean, for both teams.
Yeah, I agree.
And
more so for the Vikings.
Yes.
Because the Bears are already in. But it's going to be very interesting to see, Rick, if they flex the game to 325 today.
Right.
And it's going to go alongside the Rams game with the 49ers. So if Matt Nagy gets word that the Rams are blowing out the Niners, you'll probably see some of the starters come out.
Right, yeah.
Because the only way that the Bears can get the number two seed is with a win and a Rams loss.
Correct. But stranger things could
definitely
happen.
Oh, definitely. The way this year has gone,
right.
I mean, nothing's out of the realm. So it'll be an interesting game to watch.
Yeah, I mean, most of the talk is, of course, that the Vikings are more motivated because they have to win.
Right.
For all practical purposes.
Right. If they lose, they need a lot of help to get in.
Exactly, yeah. There's eight different scenarios, yeah. I think. But, you know, they can control their destiny. And so that's why I know the Bears are still like 4.5-point favorites, mm-hmm. I think. But a lot of the, quote, predictors are pointing at the Vikings. So I'll tell you, I still think the Bears are, you know, they have motivation to play this game.
I think they do. I think they really do. And it's not even really about just winning the game. It's about respect and, you know, going into the playoffs on a winning note. I think there's something to be said for that. And going into that off time with a little momentum.
Yeah. And, you know, frankly, a bye.
That only helps.
I was going to say, that ought to be great motivation in itself.
Yeah, that only helps.
So we've got that. We've got, obviously, the Winter Classic coming up on Tuesday.
But the Hawks playing very well
lately. Yes, and a nice early overtime victory.
41 seconds in.
Yes. That was good to see. And I also, I admit I stayed up to watch Alabama.
Me too.
And so what I love is the people who are complaining that it shouldn't be a four-team playoff. It ought to be an eight-team playoff. But yet, look at what happened with the four-team playoff. The differential is so big.
You could get into the debate. And I got into this debate at CLTV the other night. And I'm one of those guys that I would like to see the eight-team playoff for one reason and one reason only. There is so much downtime between the final games of the regular season and the championship games and the conferences to where you get to start playing at a bowl. And some of these bowls are just, they're nothing. I mean, you don't even think about them. I mean, for goodness sake, I'm talking about a Belk Bowl. I don't even know where that was. But, you know, if you were able to coincide with, you know, like the Citrus Bowl or some of the other bowls that are more prominent, even the Cotton Bowl, you can have playoffs starting, you know, a couple of weeks earlier. The kids aren't in school. I mean, this is winter break.
Right.
So it's not even a matter of missing class. But we can get into that debate on another time. Right. But I'd like to see a good eight.
Did you see the Walk-On Bowl?
No, I did not.
Which I did, and actually I went to a Walk-On. It's a chain, a small chain of sports bars, restaurants, started in Louisiana, and they feature Louisiana cooking.
Okay.
So, you know, that's where you get po' boys, and you can get, you know, all kinds of seafood along with your burger and all fries and all that kind of stuff. And it was founded by a guy who was a walk-on to the LSU team.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah, there was the Walk-On Bowl.
Hence the name.
Yes.
Nice.
So it's kind of neat to, you know, because there are all kinds of, there's the Valero Bowl, and someone, well, what's that? And I said, well, that's a chain of gas stations.
Chain of gas stations on the West Coast.
So, but yeah, anybody can sponsor a bowl.
Even the Village of Elk Grove.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
The Bahamas Bowl.
Yeah, right. Crazy times, crazy times. Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Andy has the latest sports. Producer Casera is fielding your phone calls at 312-981-7200. That's our text line as well. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob has got the newsroom Zamboni and is driving it very slowly over to South Bend for the game. You can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Up ahead, it's our annual pre-New Year's Look Ahead show as we look at what's ahead for the city with the mayoral election, the state with a new governor, and Washington with a new Democratic House majority. That's all up ahead. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I didn't mention that we've got our roundtable back from last week as we talk about what's ahead for the future. We've got Brian Bernardoni, the Senior Director of Government Affairs and Public Policy at the Chicago Association of Realtors, and Eric Elk, founder and president of Fulcrum, Illinois. They'll be up ahead here after the 7:30 news. Kind of a strange week in national politics. And, of course, we're still in government shutdown. The president foregoing his, I believe, 14-day vacation at Mar-a-Lago to stay in the White House. It's kind of interesting. There's been a lot of debate, too, about why isn't he making more of a presence on TV rather than just resorting to Twitter. And Politico has a story out today that actually senior aides at the White House are happy that he's using Twitter rather than having a press conference because he goes too far off script most of the time, and that could cause even more problems in trying to resolve this shutdown day eight. And I'm not sure how it could get any worse since there hasn't been any substantive talks between the president and the Democratic leaders, including House Speaker designate Nancy Pelosi. They haven't spoken since the shutdown began. So this thing could be dragging on for a while. But he's been tweeting about the shutdown. He's been tweeting about James Comey, for example. On Christmas Day, it was about James Comey.
Everybody hated Comey. They thought he did a horrible job. The Democrats hated him. They were calling for his resignation. They were calling for his firing, including Schumer, including Nancy Pelosi, until I fired him. And once I fired him, everybody said, oh, why did you fire him? Why did you fire him? Take a look at some of these people. This is what we're doing now. Take a look at some of these people. Literally, the day before I fired him, they were saying he should be fired. As soon as I fired him, they said, oh, what did you fire him for? That was a terrible thing to do. It's a disgrace what's happening in our country. But other than that, I wish everybody a very Merry Christmas.
But other than that, Merry Christmas. That's the President of the United States. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joined once again, as had occurred last week, with Brian Bernardoni, Senior Director of Government Affairs and Public Policy for the Chicago Association of Realtors, and Eric Elk, the founder and president of Fulcrum, Illinois, a subsidiary of the Illinois Manufacturers Association. Last week we did a year in review, and I thought, you know, let's take a look at the year ahead. Gentlemen, thanks for joining me this morning.
Good morning. Yeah. It's
good to be here.
We're kind of the bad penny of WGN, you know.
Speak for yourself.
Well done, Eric. I played the cut just before the news of the president frustrated in the Oval Office with the government shutdown. But then he was going after James Comey. And, you know, we have news now that the House Republicans have... the leaders of two House committees have finished their investigation of the FBI's handling of the Clinton and Russia investigations, and basically saying they can't really find anything wrong. You've got that. They've got concerns about bias, but not any kind of dedicated impropriety. Then you've got Trump talking about James Comey, and for his part, Comey was at a forum where he said voters should dump Trump in 2020, but also he said he didn't think a impeachment and removal from office would be a good thing for the country.
All of us should use every breath we have to make sure that the lying stops on January 20th, 2021. I hope Donald Trump is not removed from office by impeachment because it would let the country off the hook. And it would drive into the fabric of our nation a third of the people believing there was a coup. And we need a moment of inflection where we all get off the couch and say, that is not who we are, and in a landslide, rid ourselves of this attack on our values. And if we in a way, short-circuited that with an important, legitimate process through the Constitution, I worry that we'd be letting ourselves off the hook in a way, and we wouldn't have the moment of clarity that we need in this country. That said, if the facts are there and the legislative branch, two houses of Congress think it's appropriate, that's fine.
So that's former FBI Director James Comey. So, gentlemen, it's kind of like how we began last week with the government shutdown and government in chaos. You know, it just continues. And obviously, I would expect that we will see Robert Mueller's report this year. We don't know when. And it seems like every time he takes a step, there's three more things that come out of the woodwork. Obviously, you have the president's former attorney and fixer, who Michael Cohen, who is pleaded guilty. A lot of people talking. Does the president finish out the year?
You have Michael Flynn, who right. Basically the judge told a week or 2 weeks ago, you know, if he had his wits about him, he'd put him in jail now for 5 years plus. Pointed to the flag, said, you know,
treason, basically.
And so I think it's almost given him and his attorneys little time to think, because they rolled into court a little too confident, perhaps. It'll be interesting to see if he continues to work or to talk. The same goes for Manafort.
And new developments with Manafort involving a Russian spy.
Correct.
I mean, more and more and more.
I think you also have to wonder what the party's tolerance is going to be with Trump. And I think, you know, 2019 is really the setup year for 2020 and the 2020 elections. As soon as the midyears were over, you started the 2020 campaign. And when you start looking at what the Republican Party, the individuals that have been very focused on criticizing the brave ones that were interested in criticizing President Trump, when you start seeing them set up to be potential presidential candidates, you know, if John Kasich starts hitting the field a little differently, if Jeff Flake starts hitting the field differently, you'll start seeing, I think, a little bit of a more of a change of tone. There's lots of moving parts in this thing. And I think with every bit of chaos that's going on in Washington, there's a subset of Republicans that are saying, well, let's run this guy and actually make him fight a domestic political war for himself, as well as the larger judicial problems that he has, and then the international problems he has. So I think, in short, you got to start watching guys like Flake and Kasich. If they start hitting New Hampshire and start hitting that circuit, you'll see the rhetoric change a little bit.
Well, I would expect Kasich is pretty much all but in.
Yeah,
right.
I would imagine so.
But you raise a good point. For the most part, the
see, Eric, I got a point in. Do you see that?
Ding,
attaboy.
No, but as far as the Republicans in his own party, and it's hard to tell sometimes, because you know, you look at Lindsey Graham, who you know was a very harsh critic of Donald Trump, and then you know
totally flipped,
and you know the thought then was he was posturing for Attorney General, or as some suggested, recognizing his reelection chances and his constituency, that he had to kind of toe a Trump line here. But where the people in the Republican Party that have been critical about Trump are all leaving. And when will things change among the Republicans that are staying? Especially when you look at what happened in the midterms. Because a lot of them are scared about what happened in the midterms.
Sure. I think that it'll be interesting. This will be the first time for a number of members in the House, in the Congress, to serve in the minority. And so this will be a huge change for a lot of those members of Congress. And I think that a lot of them will start to look at what happened in 18, and they're all thinking about their own future. And that's it.
They're not thinking about Donald Trump's future.
Oh, no, because I assure you he is not thinking about theirs. and he or these members of Congress will start to become
a little. There's a ding for you. Yes, you ring a bell from there for
that Eric. Came from me, by the way.
Thank you. But I think that they will all start to take stock and kind of see what is happening. For so long after the president came in, the Republican Congress kind of let his policies go unchecked, and the things that he kind of bullied them into positions taking up or issues to take up.
And if they're not seeing a benefit from any of those decisions, especially when you start looking at farmers that aren't getting the benefits of, are starting to feel the ramifications of tariffs and others. You worked for Senator Kirk. That's going to reflect in polling data, in those subsections, and that's not good for anybody down there.
I also worked for one of the most conservative members of Congress at one time, Phil Crane, who was also the chair of the Subcommittee on Trade and Ways and Means. Free market, free enterprise, free trade, those were hallmarks of a conservative movement, and how those issues have been hijacked now by someone who wants to put tariffs in place. Especially with China. That was a huge deal to get permanent normal trading relations with China years ago. That was something that so many companies, Illinois at one point was the sixth largest exporting state in the country, and we're in the Midwest. We're not even on the coast. Because these policies have been put in place, it's really hurting states' economies like Illinois. Illinois's got its own issues, but these are not helping.
We're speaking with Eric Elk and Brian Bernadoni. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined by Brian Bernadoni from the Chicago Association of Realtors and Eric Elk from Fulcrum, Illinois. We're talking in this segment of the show about what we can expect to see in the future out of Washington. And, of course, you have House Democrats now as the majority coming in. Short term is what happens with the shutdown, because basically everybody's throwing up their hands and it's going to be the next Congress to deal with. But also, it was per our conversation before the break, we talked about where House Republicans and where will they go as far as the president's agenda. House Democrats, a lot of them, many of them using the I word, impeach. And you heard James Comey saying, he doesn't necessarily want to see that because of how that base of Trump's will view it as a coup. Where do the House Democrats go here?
I agree with Director Comey on the impeachment issue. I think that would be a watershed moment we probably don't want. But I think we're at using the phrase tipping point, but I think we're there with both the establishment Republicans as well as the establishment Democrats. The establishment Republicans are going to have to decide if they're going to be the party that Eric described, which is free market and going down that approach, and if they're going to try and take their party back from where the party has been drawn to or not. And I think the Democrats are in the same problem. When you have a whole slew of new Democrats emerging on the national scene, whether it be Stacey Abrams out of Georgia or Beto O'Rourke out of Texas, and you're not talking about establishment Democrats, they're in the same problem. If the Republicans can solidify where they want to take the party and bring the apparatus back to where they can get reelected in 2020 in one form or another, at least in the taking back the House and containing the Senate, this is their window of opportunity to do it. The best thing that they have, though, is a very disorganized, at the federal level, Democratic Party. I've got friends of mine on the Democratic side that just received their holiday cards, yesterday. That kind of little disorganization is in kind of a bigger opening to the larger disorganization that the National Democrats have. But it's also a public relations battle of who's going to really wear the mantle of the shutdown and for how long is that going to be tolerated.
You have incoming Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who, in essence, I think, had to cut a deal to win that position.
Right.
To promise only, 2 years or 4 years as Speaker in order to get the support.
Lot of promises are made, Eric.
Oh, yeah. Agreed. Keeping them is another thing. But I think that, you know, that to your point, that really shows and highlights they are not unified at all. And they are going to have, you know, that the Democrats keep going to the left. You know, the Bernie Sanders movement and all those, while the Republicans continue moving to the right. And I think that, you know, at some point, the folks who kind of come and are able to work with both sides, more of a moderate, whether they be Democrat or Republican, I think that's where the country is.
But it's not. But it's not where the parties are. And it's and there is no. I mean, that's why we don't have compromise.
And with the shutdown, each side is talking to their base. That's it.
Right.
This is all about just trying to energize their supporters, whether they are on the right or the left.
But I think we're seeing a redefining of what base actually is now. I mean,
completely.
And I think that's going to be. If I'm looking into 2019. It's going to be the parties that most define what the new Republican and or Democratic base actually is that are going to be most successful, because that's where the money's going to go. At the end of the day, politics is going to be is still built on campaign contributions and where that goes. And is there's the grassroots movement, and then, you know, whatever the Tea Party or whatever the new permutation of the Trump Republicans are, is that going to still be an avenue for fundraising money and grassroots activity? And the parties that best define that in the next few months, and I don't think they got a lot of time, in the next few months are going to be in a much better position for 2020, definitely trying to take back the House if you're the Republicans, or trying to seize the Senate if you're a Democrat.
Especially when you have half the Senate, at least half the Senate Democrats vying to run for president. You know, you have so many of them already out there trying to start their campaigns for president, you know, making the rounds in Iowa and some of the other early states.
And hiring staff. I mean.
Oh, they are staffing up for sure.
With that middle, that great middle. Is that where a third party comes in?
I mean, I'm looking at Eric, and I think he's giving me the same look. And by the way, looks don't work on radio. But
the reality is,
third parties have been practically impossible to emerge. You got to look. I think the last really successful run probably is Ross Perot, that was able to really kind of throw down a gauntlet on something along those lines. But.
There may be the money there, you know, for it.
Though. Well, Nixon spoke about a silent majority, and you're kind of wondering if there's going to be a new silent majority of centrists that emerge out of all of this discourse that are unhappy. But unfortunately, at least if history, which tends to repeat itself, comes true again, you need a real crisis to happen in order for people to kind of come to a middle and finding a joining moment. And I don't see one in 2019.
Well, we may have a constitutional crisis. You know, I mean, if the special investigator's report comes out and points to some significant findings, you know, there very well could be some sort of constitutional crisis.
But a crisis isn't a unifying moment, though. I mean, a constitutional crisis, I'll grant, but a unifying moment that brings the nation together or brings the nation into a position where they've got to solve a different issue. And I'm not sure what's happening with the president is to that extent, because you still have that base of 30 or 35% of people that are going to believe something else is actually taking place here, and they're going to dispute the findings, whatever it is, no matter what.
Maybe, but if the economy continues on the track that it's been on, and I don't mean the 1,000-point gain we saw... I mean, the continual decline, a lot of these folks, or that 35%, are going to suffer some of the consequences of his tariffs and imposing the different trade tariffs and things like that.
We talked about this last week, and which is why it's so important to listen to this show every week. But last week, we talked about what that defining moment might be, and I think it's when people are filing their income taxes. Did the tax plan work for me? And if people find it doesn't work for them, then you'll start seeing what that movement looks like. And I believe, you know, members of Congress will hear it. And clearly mainstream media will hear it as well.
That's Brian Bernardoni, joined by Eric Elk. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of Your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined here by Brian Bernadoni from the Chicago Association of Realtors and Eric Elk from Fulcrum, Illinois. The partial government shutdown continues. Signed executive order the other day. Merry Christmas. No pay raises for federal employees, 800,000 of which aren't getting paid because of the shutdown. The president wants $5 billion to build a border wall. Democrats taking control of the House say no. No end in sight. On Fox News, Illinois Democratic Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy of Schaumburg explained where Democrats are in this stare down.
I think that this wall issue, you know, look, Ronald Reagan said it best in the 1980s when he was president, tear down this wall. There's a certain aspect to having a wall, whether it's to prevent people from leaving or preventing people from coming in, that sends the wrong message to people who want to do business here, who want to immigrate here, and who really want to make America the greatest nation on the face of the earth. It's because of its immigrants, in part.
That's Congressman Raja Krishnamoorthy. Gentlemen, before we conclude our discussion about Washington, I'm curious, we have now divided government with Democratic House. Republicans still have control of the Senate, obviously, and the White House. So does anything really get done, or is it with 2020 staring everybody in the eye that we're going to see minimal federal government as we move closer to the next presidential election?
I think there's a couple different things. I think from the national perspective, it's really hard to move legislation in a divided Congress and going into a presidential year. But I think well-positioned, well-organized groups are going to be able to get done what they need to get done. I think an example from the past week is, frankly, the National Association of Realtors able to resecure flood insurance for a while. If you don't have flood insurance in a lot of communities, in Louisiana, all over the place, if you don't have flood insurance, you can't get real estate transactions done. So they were able to get some of that kind of stuff done. But
there's nothing getting done during the shutdown.
No. They were able to kind of get that up and running again.
Except now it stopped because the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, is noting, like, you know, the immense number of people down in Louisiana that need to re-up their flood insurance but can't do it. And by the way, 6 inches of rain fell in Baton Rouge on Thursday. I mean, I've never seen water like that. And literally in hours, it was gone. Because guess where it went? South down to New Orleans.
That's right.
But flood insurance, that is Louisiana.
Yes.
But they can't do anything about it. And the governor's pleading for negotiations to end.
The long-term fix is a different issue, but again, to the larger issue of not flood insurance, but well-positioned folks will be able to get some of their stuff done. But I think getting a real legislative, long-term solution for anything is probably unlikely. Eric?
Yeah, I think that there will be a lot of posturing. There's been so much talk during the campaign season and since a number of Democrat members of the Congress are talking about how they want to have these different hearings investigating the president. And I think that while that's important, we can't stop governing and getting some other things done moving forward. You know, with everything that's happened from the hurricanes, the flooding, the fires, all these different natural disasters, there's issues that need to be addressed in different states around the country. We can't get bogged down in having these long, kind of drawn out fights of these vendettas on both sides.
Well, there's political distraction everywhere.
Completely.
You know, I mean, you can talk about policy, and then all of a sudden, it's about emails, or it's about servers, or it's about something else, and you kind of wonder what the elasticity is for the American public on how much scandal can they handle before they start realizing it. That it's impacting them. And I'm going to go back to the dead horse, which is on the tax bill. I think people start realizing that distraction has distracted them from their own pocketbook come when they file their taxes.
Yeah, and I think, you know, always pocketbook is the great motivator in politics.
It's the economy.
It's the economy. It's
your personal economy.
It's my wallet.
Yeah.
And
It's getting lighter.
Yeah, and it's my 401k.
It's declining.
Yeah, because we're tired of winning, I think, is what the problem is. And Brian just showed me that FEMA is actually issuing policies and renewing policies on flood insurance. That's a late development during the shutdown. So.
But that's going back to the issue of personal economy, though. The whole issue of economic disparity is really it's going to be who's going to capitalize on that real vibe of the haves versus the haves nots and come up with the messaging that will get these folks to their side.
But isn't that in part what you're seeing from some of the more extreme Democrats or Democratic socialists are selling that message? I mean, Bernie Sanders, the Democrats to the far left have been selling the income inequality, you know, for years now.
Again, I'll go back to the tax bill. When people start realizing that they're not going to be getting the refunds that they expected, or they may be getting more. I mean, people will start associating the economic climate that's happening across the country to their own pocketbooks most directly at that time period. If from a political standpoint, that's when you pounce. When people are seeing what's happening to them in real time, and it you know, the economic disparity of the 99% versus the 1% isn't just Democratic Socialists. I mean, the Democratic Party, that's been the mother's milk for a long time. It's been the center of the labor movement. So I'm not sure if it's just a far left versus a far right thing. And on the other hand, Republicans, you know, Republican centrists and moderates, farmers are going to feel this stuff. And who's going to speak to middle America? Who's going to speak to, you know, Shenandoah, Illinois and places like that about some of those issues? And who's going to call that message in such a way that people get involved? I think that's the great opportunity of 2019, and it could be the great opportunity lost if people don't act to it.
We're speaking with Brian Bernadone and Eric Elk. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
Send a volley, cheer on high. Shake down the thunder from the sky. New Year's Day, the Blackhawks are in South Bend to take on the Boston Bruins in the Winter Classic. Chris Bowden's got your pregame at 11:30. John Weideman and Troy Murray with the outdoor puck drop at high noon. Cheer, cheer. It's a new year for the Blackhawks on 720 WGN.
Hey Bulls fans, enter for your chance to win the ultimate VIP Bulls Night experience at chicagotribune.com/BullsQuiz, courtesy of the Chicago Tribune.
No heat, no problem. Turn to the furnace experts at ABC Plumbing, Sewer, Heating, Cooling, and Electric. Right now, take advantage of our special holiday offer, and we'll diagnose your furnace issue for just $49. So when you need your furnace fixed fast and fixed right, call ABC at 888-809-6099. That's 888-809-6099, or book online at 4abc.com, and consider it done.
A good night's sleep starts with the right pillow. That's where MyPillow comes in, and we're excited to announce the new 4-pack special. Go to MyPillow.com, click on the 4-pack special tab, and save 50% off the 4-pack, which includes 2 MyPillow premiums and 2 go-anywhere pillows. Use promo code SKY at checkout or call 1-800-635-1825. That's 1-800-635-1825. Or go to MyPillow.com, click the 4-pack special tab, and use promo code SKY at checkout.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, joined in studio by Brian Bernadone from the Chicago Association of Realtors and Eric Elk, the founder and president of Fulcrum Illinois. Let's bring things a bit closer to home and talk about changes in Illinois government. We have, of course, the new governor coming in on January 14th of J.B. Pritzker, Democrat, replacing one-term Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. Thought it was kind of interesting. This developed, I guess, pretty much the other day, Friday. I got a notice that there's a cable advertising buy of $4,100 or so for a number of cable spots airing on MSNBC, CNN, and Fox News in the Champaign, Decatur, Springfield market. And the purchaser of these ads was friends of Michael J. Madigan.
He's got a lot of them.
30-second spots, which briefly show the speaker. But, I mean, part of this, I thought, was kind of a poke in the eye of Bruce Rauner. Don't let the door hit you on the way out kind of thing. But also, the more I thought about it, too, is this the start of a rehabilitation campaign for someone who has had their image completely tarnished by millions and millions of dollars of advertising from Bruce Rauner over the last 4 years?
I think a lot of folks across the state, when you talk to friends and colleagues downstate, there's always going to be a level of apprehension when not only there's one-party rule, but veto-proof one-party rule. And, you know, I think the speaker's in a position where he's trying to say, look, we're not going to hurt you. And I think that's going to be an important message for some of the downstate Democratic gains that he's made down there.
But I'm from government. I'm here to help you.
I'm not going to hurt you. It's probably more
this
than
is going to hurt me more than
yeah,
it hurts you.
Yeah. But it may be also a signal with him reaching out downstate that those from the Chicagoland area that are trying to push an agenda need to understand that the agenda of Chicago is not necessarily the agenda of the entire state of Illinois. And I think the speaker is being very wise about understanding that and probably not only sending a message downstate, but also sending a message to his own caucus saying, you know, I'm the Speaker of the House of the entire state of Illinois, and we have to deliver in a way that the whole state can kind of come around those issues. An aggressive agenda just coming from Chicago or from progressives, it may be a good signal for them to kind of think about how it impacts the whole state.
Eric?
I'm just curious, why not do a buy in the Chicagoland area, in the suburbs?
Well, now, according to the speaker's spokesman, that this was a statewide buy. I have not seen any filings yet for broadcast television in the Chicago area, which obviously very expensive. Cable is much cheaper and more direct buy. And that actually is a good point, because given some of the pickups that the Democrats made in the legislature were suburban pickups.
Right.
And in a changing landscape of suburbia, but even, you know, when you talk to people who are Democrats, you hear, you know, grumbling about Madigan. And it would seem, you know, that's why I ask about, is this some kind of a rehabilitation effort? Just kind of a little soft rollout kind of thing. Because
it's got to be, because I'm sure that he's got to rehabilitate himself with a number of the constituents of members of his caucus.
Right.
So that way, so many of the members of his own caucus are not grumbling, you know, their constituents aren't grumbling to them saying, why are you just listening to what the speaker has to say? Why are you only doing what the speaker wants instead of your constituents? And so trying to put it out there, hey, we're trying to help, whatever that message is, that's the only thing, you know. Maybe it is a rehabilitation.
But there's also a redefining of the party that's got to take place, and I think that's part of the message.
But is that his job? I mean,
he's the head of the state party. He's the head of the state party. You know, so
is this a fight between Pritzker and Madigan then? Because the governor typically is the de facto leader of the party.
Yeah, I don't see it that way. And in fact, in this ad, it's like this is about Democrats. It's even though it's paid for by friends, it's not like this is not the speaker speaking. This is the speaker speaking as about Democrats and kind of an acknowledgement, you know, as you said, you know, you've got a veto proof majority, a Democratic governor. They're going to wear the jacket. They've got to, you know, whatever happens, they now own it.
There's nothing lonelier on the planet Earth in politics than being a downstate Democrat. Having been from Central Illinois and McLean County and knowing what it's like to be a downstate Democrat, it's a very lonely thing. So I think from a strategic standpoint, the speaker trying to make the party one across the state is a very solid move. It makes a lot of sense. It embraces and protects some of the downstate Democrats to let them know that
some
as
of
speaker,
the final
he's watching,
remaining downstate
yeah,
Democrats.
But he's letting them know that, look, I'm watching out for the messaging that you're being told to work with downstate, and hopefully we'll keep things going on a path that isn't going to be too radical to what gains we have, especially in suburban areas and otherwise.
Well, and that, you know, raising that suburban issue, and with now additional Democratic representation in the legislature from the suburbs, I almost wonder there you can't necessarily go to the far left extreme in representing that area, and that may also potentially put a check on some of the more ultra-progressive activities that some Democrats want to see.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a tough challenge because you have so many of those progressives in the caucus that are going to be pulling to go that way. And, you know, it's going to take a lot to strike that balance because there's going to be a lot, as we talked earlier, at the federal level, you're going to have you see that big time at the state level. There's going to be a lot of, I think, push and pull or some infighting within the party caucus, both in the Senate and in the House, for Democrats.
And I think, you know, the progressives are going to have to identify what issues are going to be their highest priorities. If they try to go with everything that they want, it's unlikely they'll succeed in it. If they start narrowing it down, the speaker will have to contend with them differently.
Well, and I mean, for one thing, you know, obviously you had Pritzker who campaigned on replacing the state's flat rate income tax with a graduated rate income tax based on wealth. We don't know the rates, but you'd need a constitutional amendment to do that. And while there are veto-proof majorities in both the House and Senate, you need 3/5 to do a constitutional amendment. I don't know that you get 3/5 for that.
And it, look, again, I'm going to beat the horse for the third time. It figures out what happens in April. If people take a look at April and make a determination that a progressive tax rate would even hurt them even more than the tax cut program, a simple majority may be a problem in getting this actually done. So I think we're kind of in a weird part right now about talking about revenue until people file taxes, get a sense of what their personal economy looks like, and then to see if they have the elasticity to give yet again even more. And it's not something I'm always happy about even thinking about.
But there's that, and you know, there's got to be some sort of plan on it. Infrastructure, you know, paying for that, you know, whether it's a gas tax, whether it's, you know, through the mileage.
Well, yeah, and the mileage, vehicle mileage tax is not going to happen.
Right, but I think everything will have to be on the table for discussion. And is it going to be a long-term plan, or is it going to be something that, you know, they come back, you know, folks have to come back every 2 years or something, or 3 years for funding? So there's a number of things that are going to require some sort of new funding mechanism or new tax.
Well, I had Don Schaefer on from the Midwest Truckers Association, and who said, you know, if they had only indexed the motor fuel tax
yes.
to inflation, wow. We would have, you know, we wouldn't necessarily have the problem because we'd have a more sustainable funding source for infrastructure.
And Don's right. I'm a huge fan of Don Schaefer, and I think Don also makes other points about the fact that this is a bricks and mortar issue for Chicagoans as well. We're going to call ourselves the transportation hub of the world, and we've got bridges that are with issues and roads with issues and otherwise. But I think most people like to see their tax dollars actually spent on something that benefits a community, not just pensions. And if that question isn't answered, I think, again, majorities become a real problem in getting some of this stuff done.
Well, and you see tangible results for your tax dollars with infrastructure. I mean,
you start to see a lot of ribbon cutting as you get into November.
And labor unions love ribbon cuttings. I mean, it's putting people to work, right? And you know, I've long felt that if you've got a good infrastructure plan in place, that means labor's getting something, that means contractors are getting something, that means people are buying homes, people are buying durable goods. I mean, the churn can happen, and we haven't seen that kind of movement in Illinois for a long time, and as a result, Illinois lags, and that's where we're at.
10 years, mm-hmm. And in the meantime, the needs keep growing. It's like everything else. We're speaking with Brian Bernadoni from the Chicago Association of Realtors, Eric Elk from Fulcrum, Illinois. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin, our special New Year's Eve edition of the Sunday Spin as we take a look ahead to the year 2019. Happy New Year, everyone. We've got Brian Bernadoni from the Chicago Association of Realtors and Eric Elk from Fulcrum, Illinois, here in the Allstate Skyline studio. And gentlemen, it's only a matter, really, of weeks now until the next election here in the city of Chicago. Mayor of City of Chicago.
Never stops.
Well, and this won't stop, I don't think, because I don't think anybody, it's going to be a runoff. Election.
If only Svengoolie was running, we would have a clear, definable leader. But we're just not given the luxury of having the Maestro Saturday Night Horror as a candidate. He's from Berwyn, you know.
Ding! Now we have our obligatory Svengoolie reference. Wearing the Svengoolie T-shirt.
It only took like an hour and a half. What the heck?
I know.
I had to make sure
surprised.
Dean wasn't in the room when I did it.
Can we also wish your daughter?
Yeah, it's a happy birthday, Olivia. My 10 year my little girl is now 10 years old. Four daughters, but it's always tough when you have a birthday around the holidays. And for those listeners out there who have one that's close to the holidays, you never quite get that day of your own. And Livy deserves a day of her own today. So happy birthday, sweetheart.
And now go to the wheel, and I feel like the Price is Right. You've got your shout out before you spin the wheel.
I feel pretty good about that. And this is for all the guys over at the plant, and we're okay.
Well, in that case, I got to give a shout out to Sister Carrie, who celebrating her birthday as well.
There you go. Happy birthday to everybody who's celebrating a birthday today. Happy New Year, everybody. Now back to the topic at hand. Since Svengoolie cannot be mayor of Chicago, hello, Rich. Where is this thing going? What is the electorate in Chicago?
It changes. It moves, right? You go from in a primary election situation, you know most of the better organizations are going to figure out what that proper mix of the stew is going to look like. But when you really look at it, you got to look at the finances of the candidates that are running. And at the end of the day, you've got only four or five candidates that probably have the ability to get their message out citywide. Bill Daley, Gary Chico, Tony Preckwinkle, Susana Mendoza, and maybe a couple others might be able to actually get out there. And you'll see that starting to firm up pretty quickly. And I think it's also real important to understand the people that understand that there's a Garfield Ridge, a Garfield Park, a uptown, a downtown, a Lawndale, and a Chicago lawn. It's the people that are able to put together a message that works for all those communities that are going to be in a much better position. But at the end of the day, it's still about organizations. And I think the candidates who can drive out those organizations are going to do much better at the long run. And then the list starts narrowing down. And you've got the chairman of the Cook County Democratic Party running for mayor. She's in a real good position. But you kind of wonder if her numbers have plateaued, if she can't get any higher. She's got a very tough mix of candidates that set up very nicely to challenge her. But you got to have money, and you've got to have the ability to get out there. I think the thing I'm noticing probably most in this campaign is a lot of fringe candidates are coming out and making statements, and I think the more traditional or candidates are having a harder time getting their message out. And they're going to have to really improve their game if they're going to really be competitive in the coming weeks. We're coming to a close, really. I think we're less than 60 days out, and early voting is going to happen before then. So we'll see how it focuses in, but we'll also see how the media focuses in as well.
I would expect to start to really see the barrage of TV ads starting
January 2nd.
January 2nd.
Yep.
You know, that they've got to ramp that up. I think that there will probably be a number of different debates taking place. I'm sure that a number of those debates will highlight some of these candidates. It'll be the opportunity for a number of candidates to kind of show voters their vision. It'll be interesting, and I am hopeful that a number of the candidates kind of get weeded out. You know, hopefully there's some good polling that comes out, perhaps from We Ask America. I know that we're looking at doing some of that. But I think it'll be important to kind of see, because otherwise you're going to have spoilers who show up at these debates and just try to sling mud and get their, you know, 30 seconds on a television camera. Otherwise, they're not going to have the funding to get out there with a message, and that's their only opportunity. Right. And that's not helpful.
Well, I think there's a real important part of this thing that hopefully Chicago voters are start understanding pretty quickly. You could have the winner of this primary come out with less than 20, you know, less than 20% of the vote. The second person could be in the low teens. I mean, frankly, you know, if I'm one of that, you know, I hate tiering mayoral candidates. They're all on the ballot, but you get into that next group of mayoral candidates that maybe don't have a lot of money, but may have movement, could very easily get into that second slot, and Chicago will have a definable choice of where they want to go, very quickly. So again, the threshold's not very big. So, again, it comes down to money and organization. The unifying moments that this city needs, and the city's going to need a unifier, the city's going to need someone who's going to be able to talk to the business community and to the neighborhoods and understand that they can't just represent one ward or one segment of the population, but they've got to be a mayor for the whole city when the city really needs it. We're in an interesting part of this city's history right now, where either we can try to pretend we're Portland, Oregon, or San Francisco or something else, or we can be what we are, which is Chicago, with a unique economic mix that's a lot different than what you see on the coast.
But do you see necessarily the business community weighing in at this stage, or wait until we see who's in the runoff?
I would argue you have to do it now. You have to start really thinking about what that lines up to be, because
you don't know what you may get because in those thin margins.
Yeah, the margins are thin. I mean, it would be different if it was a three-person or four-person race, where you might have the luxury of being able to sit back a little bit and not make a decision. But I think business groups across the board are probably going to have to take a look at this race again very closely and realize that the margins are not only slim, but the candidates that might be in that second or third position, do they have the interests of the economic picture of Chicago? I mean, it becomes really basic in my eyes. You know, do you have candidates that are going to be supporting a LaSalle Street tax, or do you have candidates that are supporting or that are absolutely opposed to LaSalle Street tax? Are you for rent control? Are you against rent control? Are you for raising the minimum wage, or are you against it? I mean, all of these things I think are going to become very important to get defined, get put out there, and compel the business groups across the board to stand up and make their decisions, or at least their constituencies.
No, I mean, I think it'll be really important, you know, some of the things you pointed out, and throw in there the commuter tax, a gas tax. How are they, you know, and whoever comes in, how are they going to handle, all the shootings, the crime? How are they going to handle the pension issue? You know, there's some candidates who want to have the Chicago Public School Board elected. If the Chicago School Board's elected, who's going to control that? I would argue that the Chicago Teachers Union will basically fund and run all the candidates and be able to run the schools even more than they do now.
You got a $260 million debt payment you got to make in October. You have police and fire pensions that haven't been dealt with. And arguably some very unstable foundations of what the city has usually had pretty good, strong foundations on. I agree with Eric on the CTU issue. That's a big one.
We'll be talking more about the mayor's race in Chicago, what's ahead for the city and politically in 2019 in just a moment. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined here in studio by Brian Bernadoni from the Chicago Association of Realtors and Eric Elk from Fulcrum, Illinois. And we have a call from Ron. Ron, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Hey, good morning, gentlemen. Real quick question. In addition to the mayor's race, I'm really looking at some different dynamics with the automatic races out there. Some money out here backing candidates for charter schools. So just wanted to ask you guys about that. Do you see really any highly contested automatic races? And happy new year to you guys. And Rick, just enjoyed you throughout the year, and happy new year to you.
Thank you, Ron. Happy new year to you, too.
Yeah, I think you've hit it on the head. The contested races tend to be more on the north side right now, the more heavily contentious ones. But I think what you're going to see is a very big swing of progressive candidates in a position not only to compete but win. We're projecting anywhere from a possibility of 13 to 16 aldermanic seats switching over, a majority of them being more of the progressive side. So when the new city council is seated in May, whoever the mayor is going to be is not only going to have the challenge of running the city of Chicago, but also trying to manage a city council that may not be in lockstep with his or her agenda.
Well, and that kind of goes back to what we're talking about with the business community as well. And, you know, Eric, one of the things I've always been fascinated with in this Democratic city is the relationship between the Democratic kind of establishment and the Chicago business community, obviously more Republican oriented, and just kind of the dynamics at play to make everything work. And I would assume that there's got to be a great deal of consternation in the business community now, the uncertainty factor of, you know, who do they get for mayor?
No, I'm sure that I would think that there would be. I think that Chicago is an international city, that it is not on a coast, and it is a major international city. It's very important. And I think that a lot of the business community is looking at this race and kind of, I think what both of you, you know, we've been talking about here is, I think a number of folks are kind of waiting to see. I think some folks have engaged with a few candidates, but a number of them are waiting to kind of see these first few
see
weeks.
See if something gels here?
See, these first few weeks of January will be very important, because I think that the advertising will start in earnest. There will start to be polling that comes out, and I think that then the business community will start to look at this a little bit more and potentially engage further.
When they get some data.
Correct. It's always good to make decisions based on data versus emotions.
Well, and I have to wonder, you know, obviously, and Brian touched on this with Tony Preckwinkle, the county board president, also Democratic county chair, you know, talking about organization and that kind of thing. But I had somebody tell me that she's never really had a tough race, a real tough race, and that this is going to be a real tough race. And quite frankly, I could kind of see in these early stages, you know, she is the target for everybody else.
Battle-tested organizations are far and few between right now in this city. For years, I've triaged aldermanic and mayoral races, and aldermanic ones, you always try to target the ward organizations that you thought were slow, fat, and lazy. Ones that really hadn't been challenged, ones that weren't running a native son or daughter, folks who didn't have experience in getting a judge elected or things like that. And those races do matter in ward organizations and township groups. President Preckwinkle really hasn't had a really tough race. She's had relatively easy candidates to go with. To go against, and as a result, she's going to be tested. But I think what's happened with this particular campaign is many of the best minds in politics are split across the board. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got a lot of folks that typically would have worked together on campaigns, working right. against each other. So you have you have some really interesting dynamics of those who actually understand the neighborhoods from alleys all the way to the expressways to really put some really good teams together. So again, I go back to the basics. Who's got ward organizations that are going to come out for them? Who's got the money to get their message on TV? And who's going to be able to do it early, to Eric's point, in order to really capitalize on early voting? Those are going to be the key combinations. I would also argue that turnout may be a little lighter in the south side than it may be on the north side and northwest side, only because of the amount of aldermanic races. There are some really blockbuster races going on in 47. You've got folks like Mike Negrone versus Heather Way versus a slew of others. You've got open seats in 39, 23, or 25. I mean, you've got some really volatile races there that should drive out turnout. But, you know, everything, a lot of things can happen. 60 days is a long time. A snowstorm could change can change the prospects, happen. Right? So, but again, it's going to be organization and who can capitalize. I mean, it could be 7 or 8 wards could turn around a whole mayoral campaign depending on turnout.
I would just back to your initial comment about folks saying that President Preckwinkle hasn't had a tough race and things like that. I would go back to Theodore Roosevelt's comment, "The man in the arena." And it's not the critic, it's not, you know, the person on the sideline, it's the person who's actually been in that fight. And so whether they've been, I don't think there's any campaign that's ever easy. I mean, you're putting your name out there and, you know, you're taking all the arrows, taking the hits. So for all those candidates who are engaged in this race, it is not easy. And to have, you know, the way that these, you know, journalists now uncover everything. There is nothing in a closet anymore. Everything is out there. It's very transparent, very open, very public. Thankfully,
except tax records, tax, as we've reported in the paper. We had a number of candidates that were forthcoming, and we had several that weren't.
I want to carry on one part of what Eric said because I think it's astute. Understand that just because individuals haven't gone through a tough race, and this is something I would very much advise on, Tony Preckwinkle is a tough person. Susana Mendoza is a tough person. Gary Chico is a tough person. You've got some tough people that, whether they're in a tough race or have had a tough race or not, you've got some very tough people there. I think they're astute decision makers. The larger point of all the distractions, these are people who aren't going to be distracted from the basics. And I think at the end of the day, the people that people assume are front runners right now, maybe the number one front runner may be there, but that number two spot, I think, is wide open in many regards.
And we'll watch this all play out.
Bring us back for
the days ahead.
Yeah, this is going to be a good one.
Brian Bernadoni, Senior Director of Government Affairs and Public Policy at the Chicago Association of Realtors. Eric Elk, Founder and President of Fulcrum, Illinois. Thank you so much for joining me these last two Sundays. Time for a quick break. This is the Sunday Spin.